So we're about to start the session on capital issues for a mutual health fund in Australia, paper by Saatchi Pakkal and Peter Carroll. Saatchi is a well-known academic from Macquarie University, and Peter is a well-known former academic from Macquarie University who's since gone on to do other things in health insurance. Saatchi is going to take the presentation, and then we'll have some discussion from the people in the room. Over to you, Saatchi.
Okay. Thanks, Stuart. Okay, so you all can see the title, Capital Issues for a Mutual Health Fund in Australia. And given our audience is so large today, I'm quite happy to stop and have questions at any stage, but we'll try and keep this as informal as possible. Okay, so, yeah, that's the title. And what are we going to talk about? Well, essentially, we're going to talk about, well, really three things. First of all, I want to introduce and motivate why this piece of research came about. And I should note as well that this is research that's actually funded by an Institute of Actuaries Australian Actuarial Research Grant, which we are very grateful for. So the money has been put to good use, as you will see by the end of this presentation. And what I want to do, as I said, I want to do three things mainly today. The first thing is introduce and motivate what we're going to talk about. I mean, this is a very topical issue in health insurance, this whole question of capital, particularly in an industry that's really undergoing a lot of change at the moment. Okay, so I'll motivate this. The second thing I want to talk about is I want to talk about the idea of a mutual. If we want to get at issues of capital and how a mutual should be run, I don't think. Will he find a seat? Is there a chair in the? Thank you. That's very kind of you to let him sit there. Okay. So the second topic is about mutual. So if we're going to talk about capital and explain why we should have a particular amount of capital and how we should manage the capital and how things should be invested, then we really have to understand the nature of the mutual. Okay, so we're going to look a little bit at the nature of mutual insurance itself in the health insurance industry, and from that, tease out some ideas. Okay, so I mean, first of all, why do we see mutual insurers doing health insurance? Okay, and using those ideas, take them and put them into a model to try and capture how we should manage capital in mutual. Okay, so that's the second thing I want to do, to talk about the nature of mutuals. The third thing I want to talk about is well, once we've got a handle on how we go about modeling it, what sort of results can we get? How do we get some results from all of these ideas? And that's really about data. Okay, so getting some data and running these models through data. Okay, so that's the last thing I want to talk about. Okay, so let's go to the beginning then and start with the motivation for this talk. And that's one of the reasons is that health insurance is a very important area. I mean, I'm preaching to the converted here. I mean, the audience is all in health insurance, I can see. So they all know how important it is. And, you know, it's a huge cash flow business, $13 billion a year, clearly the largest insurance market in the country. And one of the interesting facets of health insurance in the country is that the industrial organization of the health insurance industry is predominantly mutual. Okay, 27 out of the 37 health funds are mutual. So presumably there's a reason why this has happened, and there's also a reason why it's beginning to change. Okay, so, I mean, it used to be all mutuals. Now we're down to 27 out of 37. So we're going through a period of change in the health insurance industry. Okay, so that's the second motivating factor for this piece of research, and that is that the industry is changing. So we've seen a gradual change from all mutual insurers, as I was talking about in the last slide, to now we have, of the 10 who aren't mutuals, some are for-profits, so joint stocks, and some are hybrids, so they're a mixture of for-profit and not-for-profit. The hybrids are things like Bupa, which in this country operate as a for-profit entity, but their controlling arm in the UK is actually a not-for-profit, is actually a mutual. So Peter Carroll, in some of his earlier work in 2011 at the biennial conference, he called those hybrids. Okay, the changes within the industry have been well documented in the paper by Galen Watson, which was presented at the 2007 biennial conference, and you can see that, you know, things really are changing. The industry is changing, and one of the things that goes along with change is often regulation. Following the global financial crisis and other things that have gone in the industry, okay, the regulators have been very interested in regulating the industry, okay, as you would expect they should. Okay, so one of the things they've asked both the for-profits and the not-for-profits to do is that the insurers actually have to file a capital management plan with the regulator. Okay, and part of that capital management plan is they need a capital target. Now, for a for-profit or a stock insurer, I mean, that's not a big deal. I mean, how much capital do we hold? Well, generally, stock companies hold the minimum. Okay, they've got shareholders to worry about. Their capital is very expensive. Okay, so the question of capital in a for-profit or joint stock insurer is a relatively straightforward one. But for the question of a mutual, the amount of capital is not well understood. Okay, so there's been some research done, and I mean, people have written about it in the actuarial literature over time, but there's no real clear modelling of how much capital a mutual company should hold. So this is part of the reason we took on this research, is to try and, well, essentially we looked at the theoretical literature to try and find what sort of model we could use to shed some light on the question of capital structure for a mutual in the health insurance industry. Okay, so as I said, what should this capital target be for the health insurers, particularly the mutual health insurance, because as I said, this is not well understood. So hopefully this gentleman, oh, he's managed to find a seat. Excellent. That's good. Very, very pleased about that. What should the capital target be? So, as I said, we're going to delve into a theoretical model and try and use that to illustrate this question. Okay, the other question is, for the mutuals, how should they go about managing the capital that they have? I mean, this is more well understood, and you know, mutuals have been managing their capital very well, thank you, for many, many years, if not centuries. Okay, but we'll look at that as well. And indeed, some of these things, post the regulatory changes that happened recently, were explored in Peter Carroll's paper that was presented last year in April. Okay, so he looked and commented about capital and how much of it and the function that it serves in the research that he did. Okay, so that's something that I will talk a little bit more about later. Okay, so that's essentially the motivation part. Okay, so this is the reasons why we started to look at this problem. Okay, those are the issues, the importance of the industry, and the fact that capital management, optimal capital levels for a mutual aren't really well understood. So then, to try and get a sense of how you work out the capital level for a mutual in the health insurance industry, we thought, okay, what we have to do is really understand why mutuals come about. Okay, so why is it that you see this particular industrial form, this form of industrial organization, which, I mean, many people argue may well be anachronistic in this day and age, but we still see mutuals, and they're very strong in insurance. Okay, so I mean, why is that? I mean, there's obviously some nature, some characteristic about insurance that suits this particular form of industrial organization. So, to that end, rather than looking at the actuarial literature, what we did is we went outside and we started looking around into the economics literature to see what economists and people who study industrial organization have said about mutuals and insurance. So there's a gentleman called Henry Hansman who's actually written extensively on, for want of a better word, non-standard organizational forms. Okay, so he's written a lot about things like not-for-profits. He's written a lot about cooperatives. He's written about mutuals. Okay, all of these sort of non-standard forms that we see. Okay, he's made it his life's work to really understand why these forms come about and explain when they're suited to a particular niche. Okay, so within the context of insurance, that is for say life insurance, you see mutuals for two reasons. Okay, and this is summarizing Hansman down into just two words, which was done very well by an economics professor at MIT in the United States, a guy called Bengt Holmström, who's very, very au fait with the industrial organization literature. He said, you see mutuals arising for the reason of exit and the reason of voice. Okay, so very nice ways of explaining it. Let's look at the issue of voice first. What does voice mean? Voice means that a mutual is a way of getting a group of people together, okay, to provide insurance for themselves, give them voice, okay, so they have some control over the form and over the insurance, okay? So this is one way that a mutual form benefits a group of individuals and why it adds to the efficiency of markets. Okay, so giving the individuals voice. The other thing that you see that a mutual does is it controls the problem of exit. Okay, what I mean by exit, it's a very broad term, but it means that if you exit the insured situation, you can exit in a bad way. Okay, so a mutual form of organization is a way of controlling this exit problem. Okay, so what do we mean in the context of insurance? So, for example, in the context of, say, life insurance, what would that mean? That would mean that if you view, say, life insurance, it's a long-term contract, okay? So what you're doing when you buy life insurance, you're in a contractual position over a long period of time. Now, how do you actually, you know, I'm thinking historically here too, okay? So how, 100 years ago, how did people actually think about designing the contract to make life insurance work? Well, 100 years ago, that was very, very difficult. If people, for a start, didn't well understand the nature of insurance, okay, so the design of that contract was hard. Regulation didn't really exist, so designing that contract was hard. People didn't know what to look for, didn't know what the perils were. Okay. Itchy trigger finger. And the other thing is, of course, that the actuarial profession at that time was in its infancy, so there was not really an understanding of reserving and all those sorts of things. Okay, so because of this problem of exit, the fact that people would enter this long-term contract and could leave quite poorer than when they entered, okay, the mutual form was a way of controlling that. Rather than having a for-profit or a stock entity where it was to the advantage of the shareholders and the directors of the company to make money out of this whole process, the mutual was a way that people could believe that they would get value for money. Okay? They would put their money into this long-term contract, and over time they would know that because the mutual is for their own and for their own benefit, they'll be looked after and they won't be disadvantaged. Okay, so those are the sort of ideas behind the mutual. So in modelling it, we want to take these ideas. Now, for health insurance in Australia, these ideas are relevant too. Many of the health insurance, the mutuals that arise today, they developed from the Friendly Society movement, which we imported from the UK. There's lots of these small insurers. Okay, they were dealing with problems of asymmetric information, okay, which is also related to this exit issue. Okay. When you form an insurance company, people want to know if you form it as a local group, which is essentially what the friendly societies were, which became the mutuals. Okay, people knew and understood the problem of asymmetric information between insureds and the insurer. Okay, they were able to control moral hazard. They had local knowledge. All of these sorts of things which control this problem of exit. Okay, so what we then see is because these problems exist, one thing that we want to do in our modelling is have something that if the insurance product stops, right, you end up with the cost. That is, people are going into the mutual, they're undertaking mutual insurance because it provides them with a benefit, and of course if it stops, they lose that benefit. There's a disutility. Okay, so this is something we want to bring into our modelling. All right, so, the other thing of course is you can even view mutuals, and this is what Hansman does in his work, you can even view it as part of the not-for-profit spectrum. Okay, so when we say that, if you look at the structure, the control of a mutual, okay, there, I mean, essentially the board of mutual is more or less self-appointing, like a not-for-profit. The members of the mutual organization can't actually appropriate the surplus of the organization, much like a not-for-profit. And the list goes on, okay? So mutual insurance can be also viewed as part of this not-for-profit spectrum. So what we should do in our modelling is we should also tip our hats towards the not-for-profit way of modelling industrial organisation. All right. So then, how are we going to go about this modelling? All right, so this is the modelling aspect of things. How do we come up with a model to capture this particular issue or essence of mutual insurance? Okay, now... Yeah, I mean, I sat and I looked around in the literature and I really tried to find something about mutual insurers and how they should run their business and everything. And I wasn't looking in the actuarial literature, I was looking broader. Okay, and I mean, one of the things that I naturally looked at was the stochastic control literature. Okay, so stochastic control is a mathematical technique where you look at movements of state variables through time, and those state variables are controlled. Okay, so think about premiums, think about dividends, think about all of those sorts of things. These are the controls that work on the problem over time. Now, there's a very recent book by a guy called Schmidli on stochastic control, and I thought, great, stochastic control and insurance here. The answer will be there. Flip through it. Look for mutual insurance. It's not there. Okay. There's no mention at all of the nature of mutual insurance in the book. So, I mean, I kept looking, and eventually I came up to some papers that had been written by a guy called Charles Tapiro, okay, who's not even referenced in Schmidli's book, which is about stochastic control and insurance, right? But this guy, Charles Tapiro, actually looked clearly at the particular case of mutual insurance. So he set up a model that was really trying to deal with the problems of a mutual insurer. Okay, my understanding is Tapiro probably did actuarial study. He's a Canadian, studied in Montreal, so probably he did some actuarial studies when he kicked off, and that's, you know, why he wrote those papers. But he's a very well-known applied mathematician in the control area these days. Okay, so this is how we're going to go about it. But before we delve into the question of modelling the mutual, let's look at the question of a for-profit or a joint stock firm. Well, basically, there's lots written about this. There's lots of things that we can use to model how the insurance process should work in the for-profit environment. We have all of these sorts of things about, you know, puts and calls and everything for the fair premium in insurance. I mean, you can use all of this. The market imposes a discipline on these firms, okay? But a mutual is different, okay? A mutual is different, so we have to use modelling techniques that actually are closer to the way the mutual works. Okay, so now, let me just take you, and don't be scared of the maths, but I'll just, in words, what's going on here, okay? I mean, this is what Tapiro did in one of his papers. So basically he says, let's start off with the idea of a mutual. The idea of a mutual is it has an objective. What is its objective? Its objective is to minimise, well, basically, to the members, their premium. It should minimize the flow of premium over time, okay? Because the members don't want to pay too much premium. And at the same time, we have to capture cost. The cost that if this mutual insurance contract or organization ends, the insured is going to be left with a cost, a negative externality. Okay, so we add this cost to this program. Okay, so This is the objective, and it's going to run from now till the time the insurer goes bankrupt. Okay? We want to minimize the premiums, and we want to minimize the cost. All right? So the question is, in this situation, how do we choose the optimal level of Well, in this case, premium. Okay. So how do I choose the optimal level of premium in this situation so I minimize those costs? So Tambiro looked at that particular case. He looked at it in an environment where the insurer is earning premium, is paying claims, there's an opportunity cost for the cash that the insurer holds and has to pay administration costs as well. Okay, so this is a good sort of image of the way an insurance company works. All right. Okay, so I mean that's the explanation, but I've of the notation, but I've led you through that in words. What Tapiro found in his model is that when you actually solve this problem, what you find is the solution is actually a barrier solution. So what this individual will do, they will choose a premium, okay, which is very large or as large as it can be if your level of capital is smaller than some threshold, and it will be zero if it's greater than some threshold. So in essence, there's a threshold level of capital, okay, which is basically the optimal level of capital that the insurer should hold. Okay, so this is sort of the answer to our question. What is the optimal level that a mutual should hold? Okay, we want to find the X star. Okay, but if you look at, we can solve for X star, but some of the other implications of the model, just so you can understand that this is not unreasonable, if we look at the way we look at costs in this model, the view of costs is that pi, which is a ruin probability, basically saying if we ruin, the cost to the individual is k, and if we don't ruin, the cost to the individual is the... Well, I mean, that's the value of a bond, isn't it? Running forever. Okay, a perpetuity of p. Okay, so you can see, these are some of the solutions of the model, and I just wanted to point that out so you can see that there's some sort of intuitive formulation for this model that makes sense. Okay, so this is Tapiro's model. All right, so that's the question of how we should organize or determine the optimal level of capital. That's what Tapiro says anyway in his modeling process. So we'll take that on board. We'll try and work with that. The other thing, of course, is how the mutual should use its capital over its lifetime. And as I pointed out earlier, I drew the analogy between the insurer, the mutual insurer, and a not-for-profit. Okay? So, no less a person than Robert Merton, the Nobel Prize-winning finance economist, has actually looked at the question of how you should invest a university endowment fund. And this is not, if you view the mutual as a not-for-profit, this is not an unreasonable way of going about to see how things should be managed, the capital should be managed of the insurer. Okay. Merton's work mainly focuses on how you allocate the portfolio. There's nothing about the capital, it's just how you use the capital over time. Okay. So the optimal portfolio for this particular not-for-profit situation is you take your endowment, so the cash you have, plus the capitalized value of any non-endowment income, right? Put it all together in a pool and invest it in a mean variance efficient portfolio. Okay. That's what essentially Merton tells you to do. In addition, you should have some sort of hedging portfolios as well. Sorry, the G's missing there. Okay. You should have some sort of hedging portfolio so as state variables change, so as things change within the economy, you hedge for those risks. So, that's essentially what Merton says, and that's probably good advice for the way we should manage the capital for the mutual insurer over time. Okay, so that's the how. How Tapiro says we should do it, how Merton says we should do it, manage capital. Okay? All right. So where do we go from there? Okay, we know that this is an important problem. We've got an idea, or at least we've got the thread of an idea of how to look at what the optimal capital is for an insurer and how it should manage it. What do we do next? Well, what do we do next is we actually have to have data. Okay, we need data to come up with these answers, and what we did is we tried to create, or we have, or we're in the process of creating a database of all the available FIAC data. So we've taken all the FIAC data from 1970 onwards, okay, put it all in a, at the moment it's in a spreadsheet, it's not quite in the database yet, but we've put it in. And with this data, we can look at all sorts of series, and we can use the data to plug it into the models to try and get concrete results for what this is all about. So, I mean, here's membership of health funds from 1970 to the present day. We've got the balance of funds for the health insurers over time. You can look at investments over time, the aggregate level of investments, the benefit payments the health insurers have made over time, contribution income that they've earned over time, investment income. So, I mean, this is, you know, with data, there's always problems. So, I mean, there's no data before 1990. We've got a bit of a problem between 2004 and 2008. But, I mean, there is at least some data there. But as in all cases with data, you've got to manage it. Management expenses, operating profit and loss. These are all the sort of variables that will feed into the modelling process that we're going to use. All right. So with the data, we can actually look back at Carroll's paper that he presented at the biennial conference last year and put numbers in and see whether his model actually makes sense. One of the things Carroll claimed towards the end of his paper is he said that a mutual can actually reduce prices, so in other words, give money back to its policyholders, so provide that benefit to policyholders without weakening its capital position, if this holds, okay? If the rate of growth on its estate is greater than or equal to the rate of growth of policies and the rate of growth of premium, okay? If that inequality holds, and for that inequality hold, K must lie between 0 and 1. Now, K is not going to lie between 0 and 1 if I, the growth rate on the endowment, is low. Okay? All right, so basically Carroll's model won't work if I is low. But we don't know whether I is low. We don't even know what I is, or F or G. Ah, but we do now because we have data. All right? So we can take these data and we can plug them into the model, and we can actually see whether this is all going to work out. All right, so that's what we can do with that model. For Tapiro's approach, which he actually came up with this X star, which is the optimal level of capital, right? We can actually work out what X star is. We can calibrate his stochastic control model to the Australian private health insurance industry, and we can solve it using numerical methods, okay? And we can actually come up with X star for a company, okay, for the industry, whatever. Okay, but we can make a start. Maybe it doesn't make sense. Maybe we have to adjust to Tapiro's model, but at least we can have a crack at it and see what the optimal level of capital is. Okay, and that's really all I have to say. It's some of the references for the material that I was talking about. So, any questions?
Thanks, Archie. Yeah, we'll take questions, and people should speak their name into the microphone and the question into the microphone, because we're all being recorded. I've got just a couple of questions to start with.
Sure.
This is like a research in progress.
Correct.
And how long will it take until the results come through, like it finalised?
Well, to actually get the solutions, like for Carroll's model, for Tapiro's model, I mean, hopefully, I mean, things in academia go very slowly. We have to do all sorts of things like teach and mark assignments and exams and things like that. So, a year or so, hopefully we'll have something out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just out of interest, was it difficult to get the research money for this topic, or easy? Or
We were very lucky. We wrote a grant application, and the Institute viewed it favourably and gave us some money.
Okay.
So that was good.
Good. I just realised I didn't introduce myself as chairman, Stuart Roger.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? I'm sure the audience is just...
Back to the Tapiro's model,
yeah,
or the solution for it. Yeah, that one. You just explain in the solution at the top, E0. I think that took you to, maybe it's obvious I was missing, but it took you to, I think, the conclusion that the optimum capital was X star.
Correct.
Why is that? Why isn't it? Look at this, Ryan. So if I hold a dollar of capital, the premium is still the same. If I hold, earns capital at premium zero. And I thought you were saying that the objective was to minimise premium earlier for hypothesising.
That's right, yeah.
To minimise premium. So picture X star, then you are just at the point where the premium is max P as opposed to zero.
That's right, it's a threshold. Okay, so it's the threshold of capital.
Yeah, why is that the right capital answer for under this particular formula?
Okay.
Zero
or three times X star. Okay, so I mean, it's a threshold value. So if you were at zero capital, then the members in the fund would be paying P all the time. Okay, because zero is less than X star, presumably. Okay, so if you're at any level of capital below X star, then you will be paying premium. Okay, once you're above X star, you pay no premium. So if you're running your insurance company and if you can keep the capital at X star plus epsilon, right, no one will ever have to pay premium ever again.
So when you say the capital is optimized, you're actually also implying a judgment about the premium, and I think the judgment is that the premium will be as high as it possibly can be until you no longer need to build capital. And so that equation is ignoring the market competition pressures. Is that correct?
It is. It's very much ignoring market competition.
Yeah, it's basically saying charge as much as you can until your capital base allows you to charge nothing.
That's right.
Then charge nothing.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. That sounds like a generation equity problem to me.
And also a commercial problem.
Well, this is the thing. They're mutuals, right? So, I mean, you've got people banding together. I mean, this, of course, is less true now. Yeah.
Because if the proposition is to have got to a position, so again, we're talking mutual, so no one subscribed check out this at the outset. If the mutual gets itself to a position where it's got sufficient capital for future premiums to be zero, where you've got members who are continually coming and going, or going and you want to come in, that sounds to me like a fundamental
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're saying. The model, in, to some extent, is simplified because this premium, you can make this a little bit more sophisticated, right, in terms of the way premium behaves over time. Okay, so what Tapira did in this particular solution is he wanted the simplest answer in the simplest case. So he said, if I hold premium constant, if I want P to be a constant, what will the solution be? Okay, and this is what you find. Now, what you can do, I mean, generational inequity is a problem, but what you can view, mindful of time.
No, keep going, but I just want to jump in. If you go to the next slide.
Yep.
Previous one, sorry, the barrier one. Oh, lost it. The barrier
that
equation.
One?
Okay.
That one there.
Generational equity has been ignored in formulating that premium. If you put in a constraint about generational equity, such as every policy holder should at least pay the expected cost of their claims as a premium, then you could put that into that equation as well, and your premium then would become something that dealt with generational equity.
Yeah, I don't think I disagree with that. People, alternatively, at least in the old asset sharing world, afterwards, they would say if every member takes out the put in, so they subscribe, effectively making a contribution to the state on the way in and receiving the benefit of the state on the way out, however it's to be constructed.
Yeah.
I think either of those, I think it's been...
Yeah.
But I don't agree
Yeah, sure, sure. No, that's fine. No, this is a simple idea.
It lacks something, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Tapiro wasn't an actuary. Mm. So, I mean, you can, you know, like you say, you can add, I mean, there's the constraints. Mm. You just add some other sort of constraint.
Which
would be
a useful bit of
useful,
research.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, yes.
The other observation to my mind that I've probably disclosed, I think I've probably worked on all the initializations in Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
Deciding actually. But one of my observations would be that you get to a point where the model gets stressed, that it breaks. There are a number of things that can cause mutuals to decide that their destiny no longer lies in remaining as a mutual.
That's right.
And so another constraint. Constraining condition on this could be how it's to be formulated, subject to these things which are deemed to be necessary to provide for a sustainable mutual. Now that might be avoidance of intergenerational equity, it might be the not sandbagging cap, or it could be a whole range of things. So, to me, that's kind of an
excellent. That's
right. All right. Sachi, I'm going to close the session there with a vote of thanks to you and to Duncan, who is the last speaker as well. Good luck with the rest of the research, Sachi, and we have a bottle of wine.